Welcome to The Human Way. I am your host, Matt Havens, and on this episode, I'm talking with Scott Wells, who's a senior relationship manager at Bank of America. We talk about how the financial crisis had an impact on the banking world and people. We talk about how we can build stronger relationships by developing trust, and also how we can learn from the experiences of others when we don't have the fortune of necessarily going through those ourselves. It was a great conversation with Scott. I'm excited for you. Let's get started. Hey, Scott, how are you, sir?
Hey, Matt, how are you doing?
I am doing well. It is a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. To everybody who has not met Scott before, Scott's a senior business banking relationship manager at Bank of America. And we got connected just via LinkedIn. Also, our universities, we both are Miami University Red Hawks, so go Red Hawks.
Interesting thing, Matt, I was actually a split because I was a Redskin when we first joined.
And oh, then that's they changed. Right.
So I joined in, I was in college in 96, which makes me a little old, but in 97, they switched to the from the Redskins to the Red Hawks for true reasons, a good racist mentality, but the Red Hawk, I'm a Red Hawk and a Redskin, so we will go with the Red Hawks because that's the right way to look at it.
You know, my first year of college would have been 2001, so I was just a little bit behind you, and I believe there was still like the old paraphernalia that was still like in the student center. But man, that was my experience in Miami was nothing but good. It was a great university experience. Also, a lot of life lessons. I mean, I think that's what college is supposed to be for.
Agreed. Yeah.
Spending time at
Bagel and Deli at, 2 in the morning.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The 2 a.m. You know, because what else do you need at 2 o'clock in the morning than like a huge bagel sandwich full of everything that's not going to make you feel good in the morning?
Exactly.
what was like, if you think back to your college days, what was some of the things that you'll take away for experiences that you've kept now throughout your career?
I'd say that the biggest takeaway from college is learn to know who you are as a person outside of business, outside of life in general, right? Just from your parents' house. You spend 18 years living with your family and have these parents to set these rules for you. And then you go to college and you're off on your own and you have to worry about doing your own laundry. Make sure you have no money. Make sure you eat properly. Hydrate yourself, exercise, do what makes you happy. But it's learning who you are as a person that you're not taught necessarily in high school. When you are on your own, you have to make all these decisions that your parents or your family made for you, unbeknownst to you a lot of times. And then you just have to go with it and figure out what you like, what you enjoy, kind of your thoughts. I think a lot of people in high school and growing up, they kind of figure out what they want to do. I was not like that. I was not that type of person. I didn't really have any clue who I was. And in some regards, still don't, but college really did help solidify what I like and what I didn't like. And so it was an eye-opening, a learning experience from that perspective.
Well, I'm glad that you say that because as a keynote speaker, you know, corporate trainer, that was certainly not something I studied in college. So I was like you, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do coming out of college, but my experience with Miami, like I said, was really, really good. But there's a couple of things that I would say I specifically learned that I still take with me today. One was I had, just like most people when they go off to college, I had this great appreciation for my family and for my upbringing that I would have never got if I hadn't gone, I think, to do some of that. So I remember one time, this was like junior year. My roommates and I, we decided that we wanted to have family dinners on Sunday night. You know, it was this corny little thing that we did, but each week somebody was responsible for making dinner for everybody. And I remember the first time I did it, I'm trying to like get the steaks done at the right time, that the vegetables done, and I'm running around, you know, this is my first time trying this. And I call my mom because in the moment I realized my mom did this for me every night. My mom was really big on family dinners that we had. It didn't matter if we were off at friends, if we had sporting events, we were going to have family dinner Monday through Friday. And, and I would even get teased like my friends like, oh, you got to go home and have dinner with your mom. But we would do it. And so I called her in that moment. I said, Mom, this is really hard. Like I can't get this stuff timed up right. And you did this for me every night. Just, you know, thank you. I really, really appreciate that. And she was silent. She was, because she was sobbing. She was just like, thank you. I'm glad that you appreciated it. so, you know, there's like, I think life lessons like that that we learn.
Yeah,
but another thing, and this is a question I like to ask a lot of people, because another thing I think college teach us is like that it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to fail sometimes. It's okay to get it wrong. And that's certainly a time where hopefully you can kind of learn it in a safer type environment. And other times we make mistakes that may have longer impacts. But one of the questions I like to ask all the guests on the show is, do you have some sort of favorite failure or something that as you look back now, or maybe in the moment you realized it, that, hey, this is okay. This is going to be all right. This is a good learning experience. Is there any stories that you could share with us? That doesn't have to be college. It can be post-college career, but any of your favorite failures that you could share with us?
There's a couple of them, Matt, I'll be honest. But I will start with the best one, because we were talking about college, and I will go into that a little bit here. And to your point, when you go to college, you really don't have any clue really what you want to do. There's certain people that have their whole lives mapped out, like, I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to pre-med, I'm going to do this, blah, 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 blah. I'm going to Harvard, you know, medical school, blah, and I'm going to be a doctor, right? Or neurosurgeon. I had no clue who I was, let alone what I wanted. You know, I knew I was interested in space and aviation and physics and math, and I was really good at math and algebra and calculus, et cetera. And so I went into school having passed out all calculus, all algebra and business classes. I thought, you know, hey, I'm going to go in and become an aeronautical engineer. Unbeknownst to me, thinking that Miami doesn't have an aeronautical engineering program. they have a paper science engineering program. So I'm just thinking, I'll do this engineering, I'll do a physics class, and I'll figure out what I want to do from there. I took a couple classes, and then I realized quickly that and then I pivoted to saying, okay, what do I do like in life? I love math. I love this accounting perspective. And I'm thinking, my dad was a small business owner, so maybe I'm destined to become a business major. So I guess my kind of answer to first question, favorite failure, would be like realizing that I wasn't good at physics. I wasn't good at this. I wasn't good at the labs. I wasn't understanding of how those translate. I was still very interested in it, but I knew it wasn't the right fit for me for my life.
That's a good recognition. I mean, so I think sometimes we need to realize that.
So seeing that and just going, this is not the right fit. Let's pivot and see where I go. And luckily enough, I found a major that I really enjoyed and was able to turn it into a decent career.
Yeah. Now you have an extensive banking background, you know, multiple different roles and size of the banking world. Did you jump out of college straight into sort of a banking role?
Yeah, so like a lot of people at Miami, and you probably knew this, Matt, like, or saw this, you know, by September, October of their senior year, a lot of people are already sitting getting their jobs. You know, a lot of them had internships this summer and were getting offers for starting in June. I never got those. I didn't do an internship. I did a European tour before my senior year and figured, you know, I'll try something. You know, I'll figure out where it goes. And so come, you know, March, April, I'm still not still don't have a job. I just still don't have this idea. So I know I had interviewed for a banking job at Comerica Bank in Detroit. Never been in the state of Michigan prior to that. Well, we passed through to go to Windsor, as you probably are familiar in Canada. You could drink it in 18, 19, but never been in Detroit. I had one opportunity there and also had an opportunity to go into a finance role in Connecticut with an advertising company. You know, both opportunities seemed great. And I thought to myself, you know, where is this life going? And when it came down to it, I saw that banking offered me, number one, a way to really get involved with several different industries, companies, really get to know the ins and outs of different parts of business, right? So I finally got the offer from Comerica. It was, to be honest, it was less money and less opportunity than the role in Connecticut, but I'm like, I'm close to friends and family. Family was in Chicago and Cleveland and Cincinnati. And I'm like, why not just take a job in Detroit? I'm staying in the Midwest, I'll be close to everybody and let's see where this goes. So I was lucky enough to take that opportunity and run with it. it started a 20-year career in banking so far, and we'll see where that goes from now. But it gave me an opportunity to understand the world of formal credit training program, which, to be honest, doesn't exist anymore. And I don't think it exists. It stopped existing from big banks in 2005. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky enough to get in there and have this training program to kind of get you off the right foot. It wasn't like you're thrown into a role and go. This was, let's get you connected within the organization. Let's explore what you like and what you don't like, and see where your life goes. It really is kind of that perfect offset from, hey, I majored in something now. Now I can use that, but also can figure out what about that I like or I don't like. To be honest, there's people that started with me that were within 6 months were out of banking. Like, I don't want to do this anymore. This is not what I like. And then there's other people who have spent 20 plus years at the same organization. Mm-hmm. I didn't, but you know, you find a way to figure out what you like in life and in your career.
Well, and I think another thing that you said there that I think is really important, and sometimes, so like I talk a lot about generational differences. So I deal with a lot of, young people coming out of college and trying to figure out things. But I think now, especially with a lot of people looking for jobs right now, or maybe switching careers later in their career, I think one of the things that you pointed out that's really important for people to understand is that life's really about experiences.
Yes.
Being human is about these experiences that we're going to get the pleasure to go through. And particularly when it comes to jobs and maybe switching careers or taking that first job, I always try to encourage people to focus on the types of experiences that you're going to get, because you're right. Yeah. These jobs may be less money than you're currently making right now. If you're switching careers in your 30s or your 40s, they might be in a completely different industry that might be not the same level of responsibility you had. Or if you're a young person coming out of college, I think one of the traps we fall into is we look at some of these things that our peers or our friends are doing.
Yeah. Yep.
And we try to make comparisons. Oh, well, you know, they're getting a job that's X amount of money, so that's what I should be getting.
Yeah.
And instead, if you focus on, well, what types of experiences am I going to get, and what doors will that open up for me?
Yeah.
Or am I just super interested in this? And I don't care that the money's not as good, but I'm going to love going into work every day because I'm going to be excited to work on X, Y, or Z. You know, I think that's important for people to kind of recognize and focus less on maybe the trivial things or the physical things, and focus a little bit more on the experiences.
Yeah. And I'll say this, when I joined Comerica and after their training program, I got a chance to work with a group of people that I really enjoyed with, talking to every day. You know, the toughest part is you're starting from scratch. Like I said initially, I didn't know anybody in the state of Michigan. You know, I'm coming to work every day, and the only people I really knew were my friends from college, who were off in different cities, you know, and then these work friends. And what I found is that the people you spend your majority of your time with, you enjoy being around them. Life experiences just happen, right? There are times that, you know, I spent, you know, times going to baseball games, opening day at Comerica Field. I remember it was against the Cleveland Indians, surprisingly, and it was snowing outside. And you're thinking to yourself, but you had a blast hanging out with some of these people because you got to some of these experiences that you weren't necessarily ready for. Right. That's life. That's being a human experience. It's just like you have to, when you're right out of college or even making a job switch, there's many factors other to think about than other than just pay. Mm-hmm. And it's quality of life. It's, you know, work-life balance. Is it passion? You know, people throw around this idea of following your passion. It's not necessarily about following your passion. I think it's more about testing your interests. Is it something you're very interested in, or is it something you just have a passive interest in?
Yeah.
If it's just a passive interest, maybe that's not the right career field for you, but it's something worth checking out.
Absolutely.
And maybe there is something there to it, but maybe there's a different aspect you can take and pivot from there.
And also, I think the organizations that, that really focus on building that sort of culture? Because like what you just described is a culture and environment at work that you enjoy the people around you. It doesn't mean that, and I'm sure I'm willing to bet that it doesn't mean that you were best friends with every single person you worked with, but there was a culture there that was inviting. You felt a part of it, and that made going to work and doing the work that much more enjoyable.
Exactly.
There's organizations that are, you know, we just filmed a video series around conflict management and how we work together in the workforce. And at the core of that issue oftentimes is it's less about how do you resolve conflict? And it's more about let's look at the community that you guys have there and let's talk about the environment and the culture. And we have to start there before we can then figure out how to resolve conflicts, because I think the statistics, it's off the top of my head, it's something like 70% of workplace conflict just deals with communication and not feeling heard. Well, to me, that's more of like a culture and environment standpoint, but so that's good. So you found, and then now, and it sounds like you've made a couple moves now. So you, then went from Detroit to Chicago, and now I believe you're in Arizona. So you're you're kind of world jetting around the United States, doing the banking life.
What's the interesting thing? So just to kind of, you set the stage a little bit there. I spent, you know, 3 years at Comerica in Detroit, and to be honest, that world was great. I got to know, I had good friends, kind of talked about that, but I realized that there was just something missing. And what it was I found Monday through Friday were great. You know, I enjoyed my work, I enjoyed the people, but come Friday at 5, 6 o'clock, you know, my weekends were empty. I didn't have people around me. The people I was working with were work friends. So we spent time to work, but we didn't go out after work, and we didn't, you know, go see a movie or do something together during the weekends. So I found that after 3 years of doing this, I just was missing something in my life. I was going to visit friends in Chicago, driving to Chicago or Cincinnati pretty much almost every weekend. And that wears on you too. It's like, what are you doing? Like if you in Monday through Friday, but you are starving for friendship, kinship, you know, activity on the weekends, that's not a good life balance. You're not enjoying what you're doing. Your whole situation is built on this job, and that's going to lead to burnout eventually. Right.
Yep.
So I made the decision that at that time I had a friend that was running a mortgage business in Cincinnati. I also had a couple of friends that were running consulting businesses in Chicago. And I'm like, I like the idea of living in a bigger environment. I'm in a metro area that's not huge, Detroit. No one really goes downtown. Everybody lives in the suburbs. Whereas in Chicago, you can go down to Wrigley and party at, Guaranteed Rate Field if you're a Sox fan, or you can be at party in Wrigley Field. You can be downtown all the time. I'm like, I'm just moving to Chicago. I jumped on with a friend who was in consulting and it was really geared towards bank consulting. So this is kind of goes, I spent most of my career in banking, but you know, the consulting arm was about a year, but focused on banks. And I just spent the next 14 years living in Chicago and loving it. I was able to, you know, live right down the road from Wrigley Field. Spent several summers, in the stands as well as at the bars, and just enjoyed life. And it was interesting, Matt, because you're coming from, I spent 3 years, normally in Chicago, people 22, you go and spend 3 years in Wrigleyville and you party your butt off because you're like reliving or extending.
Yeah, because you're in your 20s and that's what you do in your 20s. It's
you're extending
a lot of
your fun. You're extending your college days. Well, I had, you know, 3 years of not doing that. So then when I'm coming to Chicago at 25, I'm still in my 20s. I'm still loving it. But it's like there are 3 years of that time frame where maybe I overdid it a little bit. Right?
That's okay.
That said, you know, I spent 3 years living in Wrigley. Then I met my wife, luckily, and we moved to downtown. But I lived in Chicago and loved living in the city for 14 years. It was a great city, great place to live. I moved jobs a couple times, ending up in different parts of financial services and banking, before I decided that Chicago was no longer a fit for me personally.
Yeah.
And my family, for that matter. My wife and I decided that it's time to explore the West Coast. Let's get out and get out of the winters, to be honest. I think, you know,
that's why I'm in Texas, Scott.
I listened to your podcast just recently about the snowpocalypse. It's the same thing. Yeah. It was always bad in Chicago because we didn't have these, you know, freak accident storms. You knew it was coming.
Yeah.
Starting in October through May, you knew you were going to be in the house and you're going to be freezing your butt off.
But, and it's just going to be gray. It's just going to be gray everywhere you look. It's the Midwest gray. Yeah.
Exactly.
Had that same experience and same love Chicago. And one of the things I like about Chicago that I think you're also alluding to a little bit is just it's a melting pot of people, of jobs and industries, and it's a really unique city in that regard. But yes, the winters, no bueno. And so I don't fault you for hopping over to the West Coast a little bit, but I want to ask, you know, I kind of want to ask one of the things that we talked a little bit about before we started the podcast, but kind of how we, you know, maybe got connected and interested in doing something together is because of this experience that you've had in banking and at so many different levels. So, you know, starting back in 1996, around 2000. I mean, you've gone through some pretty interesting times in the banking world over the last 20 years. And I actually, one of the things that some people, I don't talk a whole lot about, but my first job out of college was in mortgages. And that was 2006. So I also kind of got a chance to see maybe some of the financial impacts of, you know, the 2008 bust. But what I'm really interested about is because your role specifically right now as a relationship manager, you're dealing with people, you're dealing with businesses. So would you actually mind just telling the audience a little bit about kind of like the role that you're in now and kind of like what it means to be a relationship manager in banking? Because I don't think a lot of people understand what that role is.
Yeah, sure. So when you think about banking, most people think about walking to a branch and going talking, making deposits and talking to a branch manager and maybe getting your home or auto loan. That's not what we do, right? There is a component to that. That is the retail side of a bank. This business banking side of it, from my perspective, is I work with CFOs and CEOs, business owners who have companies that have been in business for a while, right? It's not your startups. It's not your retail mom and pop shops. It's companies that are doing primarily business to business trade. Mm-hmm. They have at least 5 million in annual revenues. So these are not small businesses. These are pretty decent sized companies. And I'm providing them strategic financial advice.
Yep.
And from a perspective of what the bank can do for them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people think about this role as a sales role. It's not really a sales role. It's really a strategic advice role. I joke around with my clients and my people in all seriousness that I want to be their second or third call when something good or something bad happens.
Yep.
And the best way to describe that is, you know, if you're a business owner and something good happens, your first call should always be to your spouse to say, hey, you know, this is what's going on. It's awesome. You know, I landed this new contract. Then the second call should be your banker going, now, how do I finance that new contract? Yep. How do I get the capital I need to facilitate hiring help, buying the machinery or equipment, doing this, but also maybe figure out how to utilize my cash the best way possible, right? That's my role. If it's a bad thing, you know, again, first call should be always your spouse and saying, oh my God, this is what's going on. Second call should be to your attorney to tell them, you know, how can we get out of this situation? Yep. And the third call, banker saying, what's the best thing to discuss? The banking industry should be, and to be honest, sometimes it isn't, the most trustworthy person. They should be that strategic advisor that's at your beck and call to be able to help you, Mr. and Mrs. Business Owner, on whatever you need and be able to fight for you internally to get you the capital you need or to get you the services you need to really help you take that position off your plate. As a business owner, CFO, you have so many things you're worried about, so many things you're thinking about every day. Banking and financial management shouldn't be one of those.
Yeah.
If you're the CEO, you should have a CFO, director of finance worried about that situation. And then that person should be more worried about making sure things are right than worrying about the banking decisions and how much cap, how much yield they're getting on their deposits, right?
Yeah.
That should be coming to the banker to help them discuss those options and what can be done. So, what I was saying about trust, it goes back to what we just talked about in the mortgage industry. A lot of people don't trust banks now because of the unscrupulous nature that happened in 2006, 2007, 2008. There were so many people that were making some bad decisions and that affected so many people's lives. But that really is focused on really, not to disparage it, but it's on really on that Main Street type people, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not who I'm working with. I'm working with the people that are out there trying to make things happen for Main Street, you know, doing business every day that will increase their own value, increase the value of like livelihoods of their employees, provide jobs, provide stability, provide things that business owner can provide to the people that they work for them. And so I want to be that advisor, and I am that advisor to help them make those decisions that ultimately helps people down the line.
Well, yeah, that's why like somebody like yourself, you know, I think you're in a unique role in that regard that most, you know, the average person, the people that are probably listening to this have never really maybe experienced sort of that sort of banking. What we hear is we hear the sometimes like you said, the negative news of banking, a lot of it driven being back in, you know, in the early the late 2000s with everything that went on there. And I had, you know, I had a similar story where as a loan officer, I remember I had, you know, bank representatives coming into my office trying to do loans. And I remember at one point I handed a loan file to this bank representative. And mm-hmm. I was like, there's nothing we can do. Like, yeah. You know, there's nothing we can do. I would not sell this loan to my own family member. So we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
They came back about 10 or 15 minutes later with the most wildly concocted loan that was going to it was going to be awful. And so I personally don't think that those situations are something that we have to like put on banking as a whole. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it was just like it was individuals. It was groups of individuals that unscrupulous nature of them. Yeah, that definitely made it a bad situation worse. But for you, mm-hmm. somebody who, like you said, I love how you said you want to be that second or third call with the good stuff and with the bad stuff, because you're dealing with these personal relationships and you're dealing with people who are running businesses. And so I'm just curious, over the course of your career, you know, what are some of the similarities that we see amongst people, because you've seen them at their best and you've seen them at their worst. Are there things that you've learned that you've taken about dealing with people that have helped you in your career and the different roles that you've had?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. So going back to initially where you get formal credit training in a bank, again, this doesn't really happen that often now, but they always talk about what they call the five C's of credit, which involves collateral, cash flow, compliance. And there's one more, and I'm totally blanking on it. And actually, I think it's collateral. And the other one is character, right? Character to me has always stuck out as the premier requirement in any dealing with anybody. So when I'm talking to a business owner or someone that needs advice or needs stuff, I think about who they are as a person, right? And what they can bring to the table. Because when it's all said and done, if you give a loan, if I'm giving a loan to a business owner, the business is not gonna pay me back. Sure, they're gonna generate cash to pay me back, but it really comes down to the willingness of that individual and their character to repay that bank the loan, right?
Yep.
So in my dealings, I run across people every day that I trust. There's also people I wouldn't give money to them and, give someone else's money to them, and trust. I wouldn't, talk to them really, because, you come across that person, you go, that person is doesn't have the right character.
Is there a radar that comes up when you're kind of, maybe you've had some meetings with somebody about Like, how do you determine sort of that idea of like, how do you judge somebody's character?
It's a gut situation. Truly, it's a gut feeling, and it's tough to do this because it takes a long time to get your gut and listen to your gut. When I was 22 and starting out, I didn't, have that feeling. I'd go along with my mentor and they'd say, we don't want to do this deal because of X, Y, Z. But then you're like, but I think there's an opportunity here. And it's like that person seems like a good operator. And I remember working one deal where, the exact opposite was true. All the cash flow was there. The company was doing amazing. It's right there. It was perfect opportunity. We did the loan. And then it came down to it is, that person was not the right person. We got in an argument, and they stiffed us to the bank of, they refused to work through the situation. And so you have both sides of the coin. You've got the people that need it and have true understanding of what they're getting themselves into and really want to be there to get supported. And then the other people that, hey, it's there and it doesn't matter because the bank's going to support me no matter what. Right.
Yeah.
You really have to hone your gut instinct and who that person is. And that takes time, to be honest. Like, you can't do it at 22. Maybe you can, but I didn't really develop that gut instinct for probably 10 or 15 years. Right. And that's just repeated conversations of like who this person is and what they say and what they do. And it's not necessarily the business, but some things they say about their personal lives. And it's getting to know somebody on a true relationship management level. It's interesting to say that my title is in relationship management, because really that's what it is. It's really building that solid business relationship, but also building that personal relationship.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the key, Scott. And it's one of the things I try to impress upon people when I go out and I speak or with companies that I work with, is because, like you said, there's certainly like a gut feeling we can all have about somebody's character, their situation, like, can I trust this person? But none of those things really get solidified, the first time. And like you said, it takes time.
Yeah.
It takes multiple conversations. It takes spending time with somebody to get to know them on a more personal level. So one of the things that I've always used is, and I remember getting actually coached on this at times in my corporate career, is I was very open about my personal life, my personal relationships, my family. And I remember at times being told, well, hey, you don't want to get too personal, because some people aren't really comfortable with that, or, you need to keep it about work. And I always kind of push back at that because I knew that if I'm going to have like strong working relationships with people in other departments, or, somebody that I know I'm going to need to call on to get a project done, and I need them to, contribute to it, we have to know each other and treat each other as people. True. And that includes our personal lives. So, I think one of the things that you're describing, and one of the things that I think people listening could try to take from this, is don't be afraid to let those guards down. Don't be afraid to spend time and build those relationships, because that's the only way that we're going to be able to get to a place of trust and honesty and truly getting to know people at a more personal level.
True. And it comes down to, you just said it, but also understanding that, people are curious, right? And people want to know, who they're dealing with. And if you're guarded, and maybe it might feel good in you'd be okay because you don't want to reveal too much for fear of them. But fear is not going to dictate your, if fear dictates your life, you're going to have a pretty sad life, right? There's too many things that can go wrong when you just buy in, when you believe in fear. Maybe people are going to be, are not going to like the fact that you're sharing. Then maybe that's not the right person you want to talk to or be in business with, to be honest, right?
Yeah.
If people don't want to share with you, okay, that's them. But you got to be open and willingness to be yourself and to take those conversations and just say, this is who I am. And if you don't like it, that's your problem. But I want to get to know you as much as possible, because I know that we could possibly be in business together, or even if we're not in business together, you know, there are some certain things, certain aspects of our lives that are going to overlap, and we're going to need each other, that we could have good conversations with some of each other that don't necessarily relate to business, but can help, you know, frame different aspects of our lives, right? I've got a good friend of mine that I work with now, who has nothing but a totally different lifestyle than me. He's from Nigeria originally, has three kids, and I'm not, my wife and I, we don't have any kids, and I'm, you know, a white guy born and bred in the Midwest. So we have couldn't have different lifestyles, but we get along great. When we get together for coffee, we have the best conversations about life, about what's going on in the business world, what's going on in the bank. Just, we just can interact in a different way.
Yeah.
Because we're open to having those conversations and put our guards down about what we share for about ourselves to other people, right? If people are going to judge you no matter what, so why don't be the best version of yourself Absolutely. That they're going to judge?
And, you know, another thing you just said, Scott, that I think is so important, and it's always been important, but I would maybe argue it's more important now than it's ever been, is going back to my belief that like life is about experiences, right? It is going to be impossible for an individual, for myself, for anybody else to experience all things in life. And there are some things, you know, you mentioned, like whether it's race or upbringing or some sort of background and experience that we just won't be able to experience from however we were brought up. And so that's why it's important to have these relationships with other people who have different experiences than you, who have different viewpoints than you, because that's how we learn.
Yeah. You know, that's how you open yourself up.
We go back to the example when we started this conversation talking about Miami is, I would be honest, you know, it's kind of uncomfortable to say this, but Miami was my first sort of experience that a lot of other people didn't grow up in a diverse community. I grew up in an extremely diverse community, all ethnicities, all races, all income classes. And then I went to Miami University and it was primarily rich white kids.
That's true. Yeah.
And it took me a good year to be like, oh, wait, you all didn't grow up the same way I did. Okay.
Yeah.
And then luckily found groups of friends where, you know, we could even have conversations about that. And so it's important that if we can't necessarily always experience things ourselves, it's important to open ourselves up to experience it through others.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, Matt, because my experience with Miami was the same thing, but I came from a community which wasn't diverse at all either. Mm-hmm. So to move to Miami, it wasn't that big of a difference shock to me, right? Because I was in this, you know, really relatively well-off suburb of Cleveland, go to, you know, relatively, you know, well-off school. You know, I think the big shock for me came from graduating and moving to Detroit, mm-hmm. right? You know, living, and you didn't live in the city of Detroit. You know, some people did, I didn't. But you know, going from that and then even going to Chicago, where all this, there's more cosmopolitan feel, mm-hmm. and to see the differences, you know, most of people talk about growing up in college. I definitely grew up because I got to know who I was as a person, but I didn't really get to experience true life until I got out of college and went to a city and saw what other people are going through every day, right? And seeing that experience between, you know, races and cultures and sexes and just everything that's different about people. And if you really truly open your eyes and your ears
absolutely
to what people are going through, you can make a huge difference in life. Right.
If you're willing to have that conversation, if you're willing to learn through others and experience it through others, I think it opens up so many doors and it helps us all better understand and understand each other more.
Yeah, to be honest, it's the human way, right?
It is, man. But we should end it right there, because that's the. But I do want to ask you one more question. I did that actually is a beautiful ending. But I kind of want to ask, because we did talk a little bit ago about, you know, banking and how it does sometimes get the bad rap. So just kind of from your vantage point, from your viewpoint, how do we make banking more human? How do we How do we maybe repair a little bit of the reputation that it can sometimes get? I know specifically it's not in the role that you're in, but if we're just talking this overarching banking, do you have any suggestions or ideas about how we make it more human to the masses?
I think that the biggest issue, to be honest, is a culture within banks. There is a culture, and it's bad to say, I used to work for this company and they've had their own issues for the last, you know, 10 years or 5 years, which is Wells Fargo. I worked there for 7 years. Some of those people, they had so much pressure to do things, to sell products, that they did things that were unethical and created fake accounts and do all a lot of other stuff. So there's a culture in banking that needs to come back to where it was in the early days of banking. Not so much the true, you know, walking the branch and they say no matter what.
Yeah.
that happened in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, up to 80s or 90s. But there's culture of not selling product, but providing that advice, strategically advising clients, providing, and I think they do this a lot more on the higher thresholds, the higher tiers, your investment bankers, your kind of your large middle market. I'm in the lower end of the middle market, and we kind of get squeezed between the retail side, retail mentality of selling product, and the advice side of the investment bank. So we get pushed in that regard. So in order to correct the mentality, it comes down to a cultural shift within the organization to realize that you're there to not necessarily sell a product. You're there to provide the solutions that these people are looking for, that they need, and be open. Again, just in general, to be open to conversations and listening to people, but being frank and open and honest with them to say, like you've mentioned with your loan file, there's no way I'm going to do this, right? Yeah. I'll give a quick example. I had a client to me reach out just the other day and says he needed a line of credit. And I go, for what? He goes, well, to support me in a lawsuit. I go, that's not something I can, you know, sell, to be honest, because I want to support you, but you know, when you say a lawsuit, what's going on? So I'm trying to get to the bottom of that and understand what the situation is. And it really comes down to how we can support that person in other ways, right? Whether it's not going to be through debt. But I think just going to go and circle back here, it comes down to the human aspect of things, being curious about other people and keeping yourself open to the conversations. The bank is not there's not big bad bank that's out to you know, screw over Mr. and Mrs. homeowner. They're going to do whatever they can to make sure that your loan is adhered to, right? They don't want to take your house. As much as there's this mentality in 2008, 2009, as an outshoot of those times, that banks had to collect on mortgages because people weren't paying. They had to collect on homes. It's horrible. But they didn't want to. No bank wanted to do that.
Yeah.
There's a lot involved in that. They don't want to do that.
They don't want to own the home. Yeah.
They don't want to do that. So they want to be able to. So as a Main Street person, they want to be able to understand that this person is not trying to hurt you. They're trying to do the best thing they can to make your life easier, but they also have to answer to other people too. So you have to be willing to be open to their point of view, just like they're going to be open to your point of view. So in order to correct this mentality, it's kind of the same thing we've been dealing with in every culture, every situation of our culture, is listen to people. They're trying to do their best. They're trying to do their whatever we can to help them. They're not just trying to to take your money and run.
Yeah. No,
they're trying to help.
They're trying to help. And I think I think I'm hearing you say, and also I guess maybe my own personal belief as well too, is and you said it, but I think we have to bring that willingness to have conversation and curiosity, you know, into banking. Yeah. And luckily you're in a spot, I think, where you get to do that every day.
Yeah.
Maybe we're talking more on the retail side of things where we're curious to understand maybe the situation somebody's in.
Yeah.
And how banks can be, again, a part of the community, mm-hmm. and help the communities that they're in flourish and grow. But we have to do that through curiosity, through conversation. And so, hopefully we're on, on the right uptick to see that more, and maybe more specifically on the retail side than.
I think it's kind of key, interesting to add this little angle in here. I know we got to wrap up here, but with this pandemic and COVID situation, I run into clients every day that ran into some issues. You know, their businesses were shut down, right? Yeah. They had to be shut down through different state orders or local mandates, or had to do, add face shields or do all this other PPE to protect not only their workers, but the people that are frequenting their businesses.
Yep.
So it's not only, they have to be supported in that way, right? So the bank did everything they could to support, right? It was talking about forgiving of loans, putting moratoriums on payments, doing whatever we could to help. So, and I think that doesn't resonate in the news media, to be honest. And the news media wants to portray this as a, the bank's trying to do something bad or whatever it is, because that's the story that sells.
Yeah, no, right? I agree.
But banks are just like anybody else. They're trying to help, and they're trying to do whatever they can to cope with situations.
And I think the scenario that you just described is vastly different than what we would have seen back in 2008. So I think people have to look at, what did happen during this pandemic, and how banks in many ways have stepped up to try to help people during some pretty unprecedented times.
Yeah.
I think that's progress. I think that's growth. And I think, I think we need to recognize it and give it credit where it might be due.
Yep. True.
So, Scott, I love it. I think we've got a lot of stuff here in this conversation that folks can take. And I think hopefully we've also helped them learn a little bit about the banking world, where maybe they don't have a ton of experience. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure.
And looking forward to seeing more what's next for Scott Wells. And thank you again for being a guest.
Yeah, well, I just want to add, thank you very much, Matt, and your listeners for having me here. It's great, great to be on the podcast. If there's anything they need banking wise, I'm happy to have conversations. Right, we're not gonna be able to do everything for everybody.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to initially have those conversations, and if I can't help you, I'm gonna point you in the right direction to do whatever I can to help. Whether that's in the banking side, or maybe it's just introducing you to a new business partner.
I love it, man.
That's the idea, is to be that strategic advisor and not just think about it as money. It's to really add value to a home.
Well, I love it, because that's what this podcast is about. It's about good people doing good things and helping out good people. So I appreciate that, Scott. Everybody else listening, please continue to download episodes, like, subscribe, do all those types of things. And just again, remember, be a nice human today. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you on the next episode.